All right, cool. I'm going to talk about the rate of adaptation in large sexual populations. And basically, all this work was actually done by Nick. And then I came in, and my job was to tell him that there was no way it could be true. And then he would convince me that it was, in fact, true. So hopefully that puts me in a good position to explain to other people why it could be correct. So what's the basic point? What are we going to try and address here? Just a really simple question. How fast can evolution go? What's the fastest that you can evolve? And in particular, what determines the rate? What sets the limit, the speed limit for different populations? Okay, so what do we need to know to do this? Well, you know, this is a physics institute, so there's four forces in population genetics. We got mutation, recombination, drift, selection, and somehow the interaction of these forces is going to determine the rate of adaptation. There's many more. Yeah, unfortunately, there's many more. But let's pretend. Let's pretend that there's just these four to keep the analogy. And if we wanted to push the analogy further, we'd want to know which ones are strong and which ones are weak, and which are the, you know, like Nick mentioned, all these set time scales, which are the short time scales, which are the long time scales.
What's the dark energy?
I won't even, I'm not even touch any of that. Okay, so all of these, unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And so it's not quite so simple, but let's try and figure out what are some reasonable strengths for these different forces. A lot of people have had this talk inflicted on, this slide inflicted on them before by me, but I'll go through it anyway. For E. coli, mutation rates per base pair, maybe 10 to the minus 10, maybe lower based on Lenski's experiments. Talking about an RNA virus like poliovirus, could be 10 to the minus 4 per base pair. And these are just per base pair mutation rates. If we're talking about, or I should say base for poliovirus, if we're talking about other kinds of genetic changes, they could be much lower or higher. So right there we got 6 orders of magnitude difference. Recombination rates, no one's ever seen recombination in TB. It's probably there, it's just small. And I'll apologize for putting something bigger than a microbe on here. Usually, you know, you have to convince someone to care about microbes, but here, these stupid eukaryotes have gotten in. For something like an obligate sexual organism, like Drosophila, if we're talking about adjacent base pairs, 10 to the minus 8 recombination rate per generation. If we're talking about different chromosomes, 0.5. So right there, in one organism, we have 9 orders of magnitude in recombination rates that we need to worry about to describe its evolution. So Nick mentioned that drift kind of scales like 1 over the population size. So what are reasonable numbers for population size? You mentioned that we have no idea for many microbes. But you know, here are some guesses. Maybe if we're talking about endangered species, we're talking about order 100 organisms. For microbes, maybe, you know, 10 to the 20-something, maybe more, 20 orders of magnitude there, so another enormous range. Selection, no idea. I mean, you know, you can go out there and measure just about any order of magnitude selective coefficient you want, except that, you know, it's a little hard to measure the really small ones directly. We know they're out there because we know that they have a big impact on evolution. We see them in sequence data. We know that sites are conserved, even though we can't directly measure selection on them. So selective coefficients, huge range from very, very large down to so small that we can't measure them, but still are crucial for evolution. And just to be clear, if we actually wanted to measure selective coefficients, we'd need to measure them at every position in the genome. And then if we're worried about epistasis, every combination of different positions in the genome. So how many measurements would we need to do? Well, if we just want to measure one-point mutations, it would scale like the genome size, at least 10 to the fourth, maybe much higher. If we wanted to measure combinations of mutations, it would go like a power of the genome size. Clearly, impossible, never going to measure them. So we're going to need to be a little clever here. The basic point of this slide is I'm trying to justify why we mess around with all these crazy symbols and subscripts and everything. Like, well, who cares about all this stuff for biology? Well, the point is we've got this massive range of parameters that could be determining the dynamics of evolution. And we need to have some kind of handle on what's going on. And there's too much to explore it all experimentally. There's too much to explore it all by simulation. So we need to do some analysis just to get some handle on, you know, what combination of parameters here is actually important, what ranges are important. And then we can zoom in on those and start looking at them using simulations and experiments and hopefully figure out what actually is going on in biology. Okay, so maybe now you believe that we actually need to do math, so let's go back to the question and do some math on it. I'm just going to talk about the absolute simplest case. So like I said, we've got these huge ranges of possible parameter space. So just let's not worry about the details. Let's just try and get some rough first handle on how these different parameters enter. So best case and the simplest case for fast evolution is you got plenty of beneficial mutations coming in. There's no worries about waiting around for any of them. Just to make things really simple, I'll just say there's just one rate of one selective advantage S that they all have, and just to make things really, really simple, say there's no epistasis. They all just add together or multiply, depending on whether you're talking about log fitness or absolute fitness. And I'm not going to worry about changes in population size. Let's just leave it fixed at N. Okay. So in this simple case, well, actually, there's a really simple expression for the how fast evolution goes. And I should say this expression is also going to show you what I mean by actually talking about the speed of adaptation. For this talk, I'm just going to mean it's the rate of increase in mean fitness in the population. That's all. All right, so in this really simple case, all right, well, you know, there's N individuals in the population. Each one of them gets beneficial mutations at rate U. They have some probability fixing, p-fix, and then each one provides an advantage s. So simple. You just got to calculate p-fix. Okay. Well, Nick just explained it. When mutations are rare, we use this branching process approximation. The probability of fixation of a mutant that provides advantage to, provides advantage s is 2s. So there you go. 2nus squared. Done. All right. But I'm just going to call that the bare rate of adaptation, V0, not the final rate of adaptation, because obviously it's more complicated. I haven't even talked about recombination yet, so it must be important for something. If you were here last week, you saw Gavin Sherlock's talk, where he showed this plot. This is, he took some yeast, threw it down on a new environment, and looked to see what happened. He colored the yeast three different colors first. And what you see here is that there's lots of different beneficial mutations coming in, spreading, but then getting beaten down again and going away as new ones come in and compete with them. So we've got clonal interference. When there's too many beneficial adaptations, the population can't adapt as well as you'd think it would because the different adaptations compete with each other. And p-fix, the probability of fixation, is no longer 2s. It's much less. All right, so we got to calculate it here. The obvious thing to do, well, one thing you can do is instead of talking about individual separated adaptations, you can pass to the opposite limit where we're talking about many, many different mutations segregating in the population at once. Then, under a broad range of conditions, what you're going to get is a roughly normal distribution of number of beneficial mutations in the population. So most individuals are going to have an average number, and then few will have more, few will have less. And it'll deviate from a normal distribution in the tails. We don't care so much about these guys. They're all going to die. But these ones are important because they're super fit, and they can help the population adapt. Now, one very nice result from when did Fisher come up with the fundamental theorem? Okay, 1930. Everything happened in 1930. Is the fundamental theorem of natural selection. And that says that to calculate the rate of adaptation, the velocity, all we need to know is the variance of this distribution, and they're exactly equal. All right, and if you do this for the asexual case, turns out it's hard, but you can calculate it. You get this. Can you guys actually see this?
No.
Nope. All right. Maybe if we just, roll this away.
It's plugged into something.
Yeah, but it can't be moved.
Not much.
All right, well, we now blocked a different group of people. I can just be like rolling it back and forth. I'm not going to write that. Look how long it is. I mean, come on now. Okay, anyway, the point is...
He's really good.
I mean, I could let Igor write it. I mean, he came up with it, so...
It's amazing that driving is horrible.
Yeah, you'd think that I would have noticed it when I came here before, but I don't know. Anyway, so... It's okay, because it's not so important. It's too complicated anyway for this talk. The important thing is that the rate of adaptation, instead of just increasing with NU linearly like it did before, is now only going logarithmically with them, much, much slower. So in these big populations, you're losing the vast majority of your beneficial mutations. Well, you would be anyway, but you're losing even more beneficial mutations because the vast majority are happening on all these individuals back here who are not so fit and are not going to survive in the long run. Only these ones out here are going to survive, so only the beneficial mutations that happen on these guys out here have any chance of fixing. And so another way to think of this is the effective population size is just this little tail out here. Everybody else is going to die and not going to contribute to future generations. All right, but recombination is actually going to help this because it's going to shuffle around the different beneficial mutations and let them jump from in the middle to out there. All right, so this is one limit, the asexual limit, many mutations. And I talked about another limit where they're all separate, all independent, rare mutations. Another limit we could do is keep it at many mutations, but now turn up the recombination all the way. So we're talking about many unlinked loci. All right, no one is staying linked to anyone else for very long. All right, Nick showed before that there was a more detailed formula for the probability of fixation. It's 2s over the variance in reproductive value. And you actually didn't.
I didn't get to that.
Yeah, okay. All right, so can just do this real quick. We want to know what that, you guys know what reproductive value is, but what actually is the variance? Let's say that we're talking about a particular beneficial. Never mind. I won't write it. I'll just. Okay. All right. So let's say we care about this particular beneficial mutation here, and say it happened to have fallen on a background that had an excess of other beneficial mutations. So it has an advantage. All right, next generation, what's going to happen? Well, now its kids are, on average, just going to have half as many. They mated with someone who was average, and they lost half their extra beneficial mutations. Note, I'm just drawing the extra beneficial mutations here. Then there's some background average number of beneficial mutations. Then the next generation, half again, and then, you know, one more. It's probably just average. All right, so how much total excess in its reproductive value did it get? If it started out with a benefit delta W, then it got delta W plus half plus a quarter, sums to 2 delta W. All right, so it got twice the deviation that it would in one generation over the whole course of time. Then if you square that to get the variance, you get that it's 4 times the single generation variance in reproductive success. All right, so remember that before I said that expression, that variance was exactly the same as the velocity of the population, as the rate of adaptation. So now we can have now we have an expression for the probability fixation in terms of the rate of adaptation. And you can see that if we crank the rate of adaptation up, that increases the variance of the population and it reduces the probability of fixation for any one individual beneficial mutation. All right, so you can solve this this implicit equation just multiplying by NUS to turn this into a V over here. And you get this nice crazy symbol. It's a product log function. Don't worry about it. But look at these two expansions here. For the actual rate of adaptation, in terms of the bear rate in the absence of interference. All right, first, if the bear rate is small, then it's very close to the bear rate. There's very little interference. And then there's a correction. linear correction in terms of the bear rate. But what about when it's really large? Then the speed adaptation is only growing logarithmically in the bear rate, much, much slower. There's a little bit of a problem here. Nick mentioned that this kind of logic about this heuristic argument here about how the reproductive value is determined by the single generation variance is only good if that single generation deviation, that delta, is small compared to the rate at which the extra beneficial mutations get stripped away by recombination. Now here we're assuming recombination rate is 1, so that means that this works as long as that those deviations are small compared to 1. So that means that this regime is maybe cheating a little bit. But it looks not that different from something that Boris and Richard did by a different method. So it's roughly right, at least. Well, it's something we should look at a little bit more.
Excuse me. So this calculation on the right on the blackboard assumes that you start off with a fluctuation and that decay over time.
And it decays, yeah.
Due to recombination.
Exactly. Now, what would be the problem? If it's too strong a fluctuation, then actually, you know, the lucky offspring who get a little bit more than average, they reproduce more, they dominate your descendants, and instead of decaying, the fluctuation stays.
Yeah, also, didn't you just say that recombination gives you an advantage because you can recombine on the tip of the wave?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of not included, or is this kind of the start? This is the initial.
This is given whatever background you're on. Then you recombine, and you combine over an average of backgrounds. So yes, this is supposed to be average offspring. It's not deterministic, right? So sometimes you'll actually end up recombining onto a really fit individual, and sometimes onto a much less fit individual. But remember, the population is normally distributed, so most people are not that far from the average. But yeah, no, that's exactly the word. If you have a good chance of landing on a background that is really good, then this breaks down. Okay.
How do you get to the exponential again?
Oh, sorry. So this is, yeah, there's log fitness and absolute fitness. The variance that is determines the variance that is equal to the rate of adaptation that is equal to V is the variance in log fitness. And the variance that reduces the probability of fixation is the variance in absolute fitness. So exponential. Sorry, yeah.
But sort of again, you know, all of this, these discrete generation models and continuous time models, it sort of all assume that selection in one generation is not terribly large.
Right. So that's another reason why this breaks down. This breaks down for two separate reasons. Number one, it's the selective coefficient becomes large compared to the strength of recombination. Number two, it becomes large compared to generation time. So you can have a ton of offspring in one generation if the variance is too big. So yeah, it breaks down for two separate reasons.
All of this isn't really a problem if you look at the continuous time model and sort of, you know, make recombination rare.
But if you want to, there's a similar issue with considering selective coefficients large compared to one. It's fixable. It's not that hard to fix, but you do need to take into consideration, which, you know, we typically neglect.
There's an issue with taking selection coefficients large to one, but, you know, here you kind of only have a serious effect if V is large.
Right.
That's where your theory would work. But if you have sort of a, you know, sort of a rare recombination scenario, then you
still might so it's the large
effects,
yeah,
from recombination, even though you're still in a regime where selection in one generation is small.
Sorry.
Sure. What's important is the ratio of R and the characteristic strain of selection per generation.
Right.
And both can be small. And the ratio.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But if you want to address rates of recombination that are on the order of a generation time, you know, perfectly reasonable situation, then you run into these issues where you break both timescales at the same time. Yeah. Right. So
if you want to consider that regime, you're just in V naught. I mean, V naught smaller than one regime.
Right. You stay in this regime. Yeah. No, but yeah, you're right. For small recombination rates, small compared to one, then you can deal with this problem. Yeah, yeah. But this is all this part is all for the large recombination rates. Yeah. Okay. So all right, but let's talk about small recombination rates. So now, moving from many unlinked loci, let's talk about a few really tightly linked loci. In particular, let's start with just thinking about one sweep and think about how much it interferes with the stuff around it. One nice thing that Nick mentioned is all the stochasticity that determines whether a mutation is going to fix or not happens while it's still really rare in the population. Maybe a large absolute number, but rare in the population. But it doesn't start interfering with other mutations until it becomes common in the population, because it will never run into them otherwise. So we can make this guess that the sweep that's doing the interfering just has the standard logistic shape for something that has advantage S. It doesn't feel the interference at all. And it's only, and then we can only consider its effects on all the rare sweeps that are trying to come along while it's going through the population. Sorry, rare mutations that are trying to come in while it's sweeping through the population. All right, and that's the approximation that Nick was using before. There was additionally justified because the sweep he was considering had a much bigger selective advantage than the sweeps he's interfering with. We don't have that here. Everything just has the same selective advantage, little s, but as long as one is common and the other is rare, then the effects are only going one way. Okay, so can you see that? Yeah, good. What does this look like? Nick drew this picture over here on the board before about how much interference there is. Here's another picture. Looks maybe prettier, I'm not sure. And this is just showing how much a sweep that reaches halfway in the population at time zero interferes with another sweep that's a distance r over s away from it, where r over s is 10 at the straight line, no interference. The probability of fixation stays at 2s all the way. One, a little bit of interference. 0.1, significant. 0.01, and 1/1000th, very strong interference. Okay, so you can see exactly how it's interfering here. One thing to notice, yeah, it's getting a lot worse as you get closer, but not that much worse, right? I mean, this is taking the recombination rate down by a factor of 10 every time. And the area under here, this total amount of interference, is increasing by, you know, less than a factor of 2 every time. And then the other thing to notice is, in the picture that Nick drew before, if you can see that, it looked, you had this long, slow increase in the amount of interference, and then very quickly it went away. And that was because this time scale is given by the selective advantage of the rare allele, and this one is given by the selective advantage of the common sweep. And so here there's a big mismatch. Here we don't have that so much. Here they're a little bit closer. Both time scales are given by S. All right, but coming back to that point that I just made about how it's the effect, I'm sorry.
The x-axis is when the thing appears, when the second mutation appears.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, I should have said that.
Well, you almost said it when you pointed to S on the x-axis.
Yeah, all right, thank you, yes. You can see that the worst time to appear is just when the sweep is common, but not so common that you're likely to land on the sweeping background when it helps you.
And recombination rate R is per genome or per?
Per generation.
We
just have two loci. Yeah. Two locus case, yeah, here. Yeah.
So for very tight linkage, this is basically the probability that the strong sweep lands within the first mutation, right?
That the second sweep lands on the background.
Like the strong sweep that you're the deterministic one?
They have the same strength, just one.
They have the same strength. Oh yeah.
Same strength. Yeah.
But you're assuming that the new sweep always occurs in the common background, and therefore pushes the rare allele down. It's a very, very large population, so it's always having a negative effect. And this probability is really the probability that the new good allele, which is in in the doomed background, recombines onto the background between 16.
Okay,
so
and
recombining away.
Right, and the complete linkage where you don't have that property, you might still, you know, the rare thing might increase in frequency, and actually there might be a probability of the stronger guy appearing within it, right?
But then that depends on population size, and this is all in the large NS limit. So you have complete linkage, then you have to worry about what. So the scenario you're talking about requires, like, you know, a finite population.
Wait a second, Nick, I think maybe you're saying something that's a little bit confusing. This is averaging over the probability of either background.
Yeah.
This is including the possibility that you land on the good background.
Sorry, right.
The problem is that down here, look, this is 10 E foldings before it hits 50% frequency. So, you know, it's 1/2 times E to the 10 probability of landing on the good background never happens, right? Fortunately, at this point, it's plenty of time before the sweeping allele comes to high frequency, and so you have no problem you can fix fine. It's only in here where the sweeping allele is rare enough that you're unlikely to land on that background,
right,
but common enough so that pretty soon it's going to hit a big frequency and reduce your selective advantage that you might not fix. That's when it's really bad. Okay. Right, so the point is that while it's getting worse as you go to tighter and tighter linkage, it's not that much worse. And as you go to bigger linkage, I mean, it's really an indetectable, bigger recombination rates, it's really an undetectable effect. So if we integrate these curves over time, then we get the total amount of interference that this sweep is going to cause at each of these different map positions. All right, total kind of chance of knocking out a sweep, another sweep at any of those map positions. So how does this look? So now we're applying the integral of that curve for different recombination rates, and now we're doing the deficit. We're not so a big interference is up here, and small interference is down here. And what I've shown here, this line is 1/R/S, and you can see that as you go to really tight linkage, it's increasing slower than 1/R. So that means that if we take the integral over this curve, it's not blowing up. And if you go out here, it's decreasing faster than 1/R. So that means if we take the integral this way, it's not blowing up either. In other words, the main effect, the main location, that range of locations that this sweep is going to interfere with are other locations that have recombination rate of order the selective coefficient, where R/S is around 1. Or, flipping this picture around, say you're a new allele. Where are you most likely to run into trouble? Where is someone most likely to come from and interfere with you? It's a distance roughly S away, order S away. If someone comes closer, that's really bad. You're done. I mean, but probably no one will be there. And if it's really far away, yeah, there's a lot of sweeps out here that are interfering, but they're only interfering a little bit. So it's order S away that is the main problem. Interference is dominated by a distance R/S away. And then, okay, what we'd really like to know here is how much does this one sweep interfere, not just integrate over time, but integrate over position too, integrate over R, over the entire genome. Or looking the other way, how much is a new sweep interfered with by random other sweeps occurring at different points in the genome and over at different points in time? So that's given by taking the integral under this curve, and it's just 2. It's just a number. It's very nice. Everything scales out. All the parameters scale out. And it's weird that it's not quite 2. This is numerical. It's very strange. I don't know. I don't know why it should be so close to a nice number like that, but not actually be 1.
Is it significantly closer to 2 than you'd expect?
Yeah, that's right. There's been some fine tuning. Yeah, there we go. There's our dark energy right there.
So sorry, R/S on the x-axis is again the selection curve. You have the same selection. Sorry.
Yeah. So this is the kind of normalized recombination rate. It's the scaled recombination rate.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so everything just scales with S. So when we do but they scale in S with S in opposite ways. So when we integrate over everything, it all comes out.
Sorry, what helped me to understand?
Yeah,
exactly. To what?
Yeah. So if you look at this integral, it's P fix over 2S.
Yes.
So
this is the total deficit of fixations.
Of fixations, yeah. The fixation probability, fixation probability. So multiply this by 2S to get the total deficit in fixations. But so properly here, let me.
Like 2 and 2S. It's like,
yeah. So if let me erase this.
Right, you factor out the 2S in the integral.
So let's call this this 1 minus p fix over 2s, the amount of interference, all right? And let's call it the delta. It's delta of RT. So what is the probability that a new guy will fix? Well, it's just 2s, but then we need to subtract off the probability that's going to get interfered with. So we have the integral dr dt times the amount of interference that each one will give. And then we need to multiply by the probability that there actually is a sweep at position r time t that to do this interfering. So that's going to be given by the total density of sweeps. And here I have a new variable, big R. And the point of this is just the frequency at which sweeps occur in the whole population, and then I divide by the total map length of the chromosome to get the density at each position in space along the chromosome. So this is the density of sweeps along the chromosome. This is the interference that they each give, and you see that that's exactly the integral we need. So this tells us that this is 2s times 1 minus 2v over s over r. So that's the 2 right there. All right, which is pretty wild. I think I have it on the next slide where I actually get into it. Oh, yeah, so just one quick digression before we come right back to that. What if there's multiple sweeps interfering? All right, well, this gets a little bit more complicated, or a lot more complicated, but first guess, we can say, all right, they're all common. We only care about these other sweeps when they're common. By then, recombination will have had time to bring them into linkage equilibrium, so they don't interfere with each other so much. You can show that when they have this nice form with a slow, steady increase and then a sharp decrease in interference, that they did for when they had big selective coefficients, that their effects on rare mutants multiply. Just the interference effects multiply or add, depending on how you're looking at it. It's a little less clear for the kind of the curves that we saw for equal selective coefficients. But if you play around with some numerical stuff, you can convince yourself that it works for at least some cases. So if you make those approximations, then this result over here actually works, because implicitly I'm adding the effects from different sweeps. And you get this the simple result here by just multiplying both sides of this equation by NUS. So now we have V0 over here. 1 minus 2v over sr. All right, but what does this actually mean? What does this equation right here mean? All right, so we've got the bear rate here. So when the bear rate is quite small, this denominator is just 1, and velocity increases with the bear rate. So rate of adaptation increases the bear rate, nu s squared, simple. But when it gets big, and big in this case means compared to this product, sr, then we start to get interference. Then it slows down, and if you take this way too far into the regime where there's many competing beneficial sweeps, and our approximations are probably starting to break down. If you take it out that far and take it seriously, Then this part over here drops out, this cancels, and we just get V going to a constant SR over 2. Just totally fixed by recombination. So in that limit, how fast you can evolve is totally set by your recombination rate. Doesn't matter how big your population is, doesn't matter how much mutation you have, it's just recombination. Now that's probably not exactly right, but this does show you that you can the rate of increase increases much faster, a lot of rates increasing, for large recombination rates than small ones. It's really recombination may be the limiting factor for adaptation in large populations. Let's see, the next one is okay. So how well does this actually work? Here's a plot showing what happens as we increase the bare rate of adaptation to the actual rate of adaptation. This would be with no interference if they were just equal. Here's the equation I just showed you where we predict that it goes to a maximum. And here are some simulation results. And the simulations are for different population sizes, but scaling the mutation rate in the opposite direction to keep nu constant. So small population, 10 to 10 squared, down to a moderate population of 10 to the fifth. And you can see that for the big population limit, which is really what we're talking about here, I mean, 100 is not big enough for us to really use S equals 0.05 and expect any of these results to work. This works out to like moderate levels of interference. Remember, we're measuring VNOT on the scale of 1 over SR, on the scale of SR. And this is pretty good out to, you know, 1, maybe a couple. And then you can see that there actually is more increase as we bring the bare rate up higher. It's not really fast, but it's...
And then which one's the large and which one's the small one?
Large populations are at the bottom, small one at the top. So 10 squared, 10 cubed, 10 to the fourth, 10 to the fifth. Yeah.
So we're kind of hoping that if you do 10 to the sixth, 10 to the seventh.
Yeah, the distances unfortunately are kind of decreasing between the different dots. So, yeah. But
that plateaus is what you just showed us on the previous slide. Let's pretend we can cancel.
That's right.
The second term we cancel.
Yeah. This plateau here. Yeah. And so we can see that actually it is increasing, but you know, compared to what we would guess with no interference, it's a pretty big difference. Even out here, we're way in the strong interference regime, where our approximations are, you know, breaking down like crazy, it's still, the plateau is a better guess than no interference, for what that's worth.
But I think there are two separate issues here. One is there's a scaling argument, which doesn't make any assumptions about this. Additivity and cost effects of different sweeps, which is clearly going to be wrong now to the right. But it still implies that there should be a limit as you get to large n. So as you take these dots to 10 to the 5, 10 to the 10 to the 7, you're expecting to get to a limiting curve, which won't be the same as this 9, but will be somewhat above it.
Right. Yeah. So that's actually, I should emphasize that. Notice these two dots, they're almost on top of each other. They have population sizes that are a factor of 10 different and mutation sizes that are a factor of 10 different. But they have exactly the same rate of adaptation because we flip them in opposite directions, right? It turns out it just depends on the product and you to a very good approximation. And that's not the only thing that the scale-in argument implies. Let me just quickly, before I show the next plot about the scale-in argument, just mention that we can combine these two different approximations that we just did. The last one with the few really close sweeps and
So how does it depend on nu in your simulations?
In the simulations?
Yeah. So if you didn't divide the mutation rate along with the scaling of the mutation rate, the population size.
We're increasing, if you just look at one color dot,
yeah,
then we're increasing the mutation rate. Mutation rate is all that's increasing along here.
Linearly? Because V0 is the variable.
Sorry. I should say, S and R are held constant, so this is actually mutation rate, but you can see how it varies in mutation rate, and then looking along one column, the different colored dots, you can see, that's not quite right, but you can also see how it depends on population size if you're clever about switching colors.
But does this want to be a logarithm in V0?
I would say so. But we're, yeah, I mean, can you tell? the problem is that as you get further out here, so, you know, simulations are kind of annoying, and as you get further out there, you end up with tons of different, just tons of mutations, and it's a lot of data to organize and keep track of. So if you don't know ahead of time from the analysis what you want to get out of that data and what you actually need to hang on to and look at, it gets to be a real pain. So, you know, I mean, but a good analytical understanding, you should be able to do simulations out much further. But you need to know what you're looking for.
But, for example, if you're looking for dependence on the logarithm of n,
I don't know. No. It's not going to, I mean, you know, maybe 10 to the 6th with my current simulations would not be a problem. Maybe 10 to the 7th, I don't know. I mean, if you guys can do a lot better than that, yeah. It gets a little annoying. But I mean, come on, analysis is much more fun. We'd much rather do that anyway. So we just talked about a couple nearby sweeps, how those affect it. And before we talked about what happens with all the many, many sweeps that are far away. So we saw that there was a reduction given by this amount, taking the rate of adaptation divided by S over R. That's the amount of interference from the close by sweeps. Then there's this additional exponential factor that gives the amount of interference from all the very far away unlinked sweeps. So putting those together, just multiplying, no problem. Okay, now I've got an implicit equation for the rate of adaptation, which, you know, breaks down if either of these, if there's strong interference by either of these criteria. So let's just make the assumption that it's weak interference by both of those criteria, and then we get a nice non-implicit equation for the rate of adaptation. All right, so that's a lot of symbols. Philip was pretty horrified when he saw this slide. So what does it actually mean? Notice here that there's two completely different interference terms, leading interference terms. They're slowing down adaptation. They're both linear in the bare rate of adaptation. But as long as the total map length of the organism, total map length of the chromosome, times the typical selective coefficient is less than 1, interference is totally dominated by this first term here. It's all the close sweeps that are, those very few close sweeps that are doing the interference. And the many, many far away sweeps are just not contributing that much. Oops. Oh, and so then, and in this regime, you see that if you want to, if you're starting to push against the limits of adaptation, if you're starting to make V0 as big as possible, then if you really want to speed up, you need to recombine more. You need faster recombination. You need more recombination. More than you need bigger populations or bigger mutation rates or even stronger selection. That's just going to increase the interference and it'll give you diminishing returns. Okay, so now back to the scaling argument. Using those combined formulas I just showed you right here, where it includes both the effect of the closed sweeps, where we get this the scaling argument, where if you remember, V0 had an S squared in it, so this just depends on S over R, and the effect of the far away sweeps, which does not have any explicit recombination in there, because we were assuming they're all unlinked, that we're maxed out in recombination. We can take a look at the actual rate of adaptation versus it's kind of the bare rate or the selective coefficient. And we can, if we scale the selective coefficient up, but keep R over S constant, okay? So we're scaling selection and recombination together. We're making them both bigger together. We see that there's no difference in the rate of adaptation over, how many is this? This is more than order of magnitude here for some couple different parameter values we're in the moderate interference regime here. This would be no interference up here, and we've lost, you know, down by a factor of 5 in these. Until we start getting out to really, really strong selective coefficients, and when we're all the way out here, then all those far away sweeps, then they start to have an effect. Then they start to slow down adaptation. But for a broad range of parameters, it's all the close sweeps, and the scaling arguments works perfectly. It's just R over S, then S over R that matters. And also, this, you know, it shows you that out to, you know, fairly decent amounts of interference, we actually do kind of know what we're talking about. At least we can match the simulations with these.
Just variance, or does it have some internal structure? Let's say the gold one. Does it
This is, I think that this is just variance because I didn't actually scale time like I should have here. So I ran all these simulations for the same amount of time. So at these really small selective coefficients. P fix over 2s is still decent, but that's divided by 2s. The actual the actual probability fixation is pretty low, so we're getting low rates of sweeps, and there's just not enough data. I think it's just noise. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question about the slicing between the? So when you do the integrals, you are integrating over the full map, and so at one point the selection is going to be strong enough that something very far away in the genome is actually in that integral.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mention it. So this only works when the total map length is very big compared to the selective coefficient, so that there's this nice separation where there's lots of stuff that's really far away, and then there's a few things that are close together. Yeah. Otherwise, you're closely linked to everything in the chromosome. All right. Okay, so just wrapping it all up, we've got this nice nice expansion for the actual rate of adaptation in terms of the bear rate with the two different interference terms, one from the close sweeps, one from the far sweeps. And this works as long as the interference is not too strong, and then there's probably logarithmic growth in the parameters after that, based on, you know, the beginnings of our stuff and then the stuff that Boris and Richard have done. As long as R times S is not big, really what you're worried about is the interference from the small sweeps. And as long as we're in this regime, which, you know, could certainly be relevant for viruses and microbes that maybe don't have such high total recombination rates, you can guess that maybe adaptation is actually really recombination limited, more than it's limited by the more obvious parameters like population size, mutation rate, and selection, which is kind of a surprising result to me. All right, so what do we need to do now? We really need to nail down this high interference regime. I mentioned that several times, that we don't have a great handle on that. And then there's some really simple extensions to the model. One, distribution of selective coefficients. Don't make them all the same. Let them vary a little bit. That shouldn't be too bad. And include neutral mutations, because like Nick was mentioning, a lot of the data out there is on the full spectrum of diversity, most of which is probably, you know, close to neutral. So we'd want to know how the selection shows that we're talking about shows up in those neutral mutations. Also, it would be interesting to see how epistasis affects this, if there's not just interference because we have clonal interference, but there's actual epistatic interactions. And what happens if we start including some population structure and have different mutations fixing in different subpopulations. And there's a million other things, but these are just some of the like most basic things that hopefully we can finish pretty soon. All right, thanks. Yeah.
But to what extent do you actually think that this, multiple sweep high interference regime is sort of relevant for microscopic organisms, which do this kind of, obligate sexual crossover every generation?
Oh, not much, but a lot of microorganisms don't do the obligate recombination every generation. Yeah.
But then sort of the crossing rate sort of becomes a very important parameter.
Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't mention that. So
you sort of didn't put it all together.
The unlinked loci bit of this assumed that there was obligate sexuality. Every generation you outcross. The closely linked stuff doesn't assume that. That was actually continuous time results, and there's nothing in there about.
So you basically just scale down your map length by the outcrossing rate.
Well, the 4 and the last term would also change.
Yeah, that last term we need to change.
Probably quite simply.
You guys have done some work. They've done some work on that.
It ends up being sort of r squared. So the fitness variance of r squared times some logarithm.
But one way to look at the case of a primarily asexual organism which goes through occasional sex is to say that its fitness is measured between sexual bursts. So if you take the sexual generation time, that means in effect the variance of reproductive value is enormously big because it has many generations of asexual reproduction. And then it just carries over.
Then you just run into you need to be careful because the variance is so big, it's large compared to one, and so you need to include the fact that it's reproduction is bursty in that case. Which is, I mean, something you'd want to worry about for viruses anyway.
Yeah, but you can do it in a continuous time way too. It's just...
That is a continuous time way. You're rescaling time to, that's turning continuous time into discrete.
I'm taking a discrete chunk and generating many asexual generations.
Yeah, you're right. You can go back and forth, yeah.
I mean, all this depends crucially on the premise that you're looking at soft selection, right? So in terms of the population size is always fixed, and you can use all these logistic approximations for the sweeps. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how that might be affected if you think of selection in terms of a hard selection, let's say for pesticide resistance or for antibiotics resistance. Mm-hmm. So it means you have some force that decreases your population size, and the adaptation is more recovering from that external force that tries to kill you. I mean, it's probably too hard to treat that analytically, right?
I think Sally's done some work quite good on this, that if you have a branching process, then all that matters is not a selection curve, but the total rate of growth. So if you've got a population which is growing in size, and then you have a selective branch on top of that, actually what matters is the growth rate of the population. So something can get established regardless of the slightly natural size.
So
the branching process still works, but you take into account the growth of the population.
Everybody gets this free bonus.
Yeah. So, but in that scenario, you could have strong adaptation with a constant growth rate, right? So it just keeps you from dying, basically.
Oh, there's everybody's fitness is just decreasing in time because of exterior factors.
Yeah.
But then I think it works out the same as ours. It's really.
That's the question, right? That's,
yeah. I think it'd be the same. I guess, but I haven't thought about it. This is not really answering your question, but for the logistic curves, it really, all that matters actually is the piece in the middle where it's, away from the boundary. So if there's something different right at when it's coming close to, when sweeps are coming close to fixation, something is something weird there, that doesn't matter. But that's not really your question. Yeah.
Good question.
So maybe another thing. So this reminds me a bit on the Hall length limit, right? I mean, it's probably different because Hall length limit is more that.
I forget what Hall length limit is.
The maximum substitution load.
Oh.
And one of the 300 generations.
Exactly, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think there the rationale was that you just cannot afford it because there would be too much dying. So it's kind of more this hard selection argument than all. So you're not forcing your population size to remain constant.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you think there's a...
Yeah, so people have kind of ignored the whole day limit because if you have some kind of truncation selection or some kind of negative antithesis, then you can basically push through a very, very large number of substitutions. Basically because in a sexual population, recombination generates variation in fitness and enables you to evade that. But it's not. It would be nice to put the two together.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you assume linkage equilibrium, multiplicative effects, and elasticity, then all length limit is a real limit. People just ignored it since the 70s, because they came up with these arguments of truncation selection and stasis of some kind, which gets you around it. But it will be interesting to look at it in this framework and ask about when the combination can allow you to escape. We will need to put in epistasis and we will need to put in democracy.
And the simple calculations suggest that it's even worse than Hall-length limit because he was ignoring this.
He was ignoring any effect of Hill-Robinson kind of experience.
Yeah.
me a question. This is all a very nice, simple approach to the case when we have a stationary process. When we insert mutations, they are either lost or fixed. Insert mutation, either lost or fixed, and that's what the whole discussion was about. Have you considered the case of a stationary process with standing variation and non-mutation rate? Using similar approach.
I haven't. Nope. have you?
It's difficult to think of how you do it with the branching process, because of course then, if you're talking about standing variation, you've got things that are common, but if they will all get established.
You could think of the standing variation as being like a snapshot of the population. Some of those standing variations will be, yeah, some standing variations will be rare, and other stuff will be more.
So let's have a picture of a whole range of variants. Some very rare, some in the branching process review, some quite common. Mm-hmm. If you have strong interference, you've got tight linkage, then what will happen is that effectively even ones that are in present in a large number of copies can still get knocked out of the population. So you might be able to somehow splice this method in to at least ask about the contribution of moderately rare ones, so 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, let's say, in the initial population. What are their chances? So you could apply the same methodology, at least to the tail of somewhat rare standing variation.
I think it's a good point, because if we're talking about something like what Philip was talking about, you got a population, all of a sudden it gets hit with pesticide resistance, so the selective regime changes, and all these mutations that before had one effect now have a new set of effects. You've got all the standing variation, and we want to understand how quickly it adapts to that is crucial. Or if we want to understand like almost any experimental evolution project, then maybe it's a different question where you start with very little variation. You start with maybe a clonal population, put it in a new environment, and then you have to establish the variation and get the wave going. This doesn't address either of those. It's all an equilibrium case. Yeah.
For example, one of the speculations was that perhaps the origin of not necessarily correct speculation, but the origin of beneficial mutations in the HIV is compensation of the initial antigenic escape, for example. And then if selection coefficient is small, let's say 1%, this transitory process can go for thousands and thousands of generations. Mm-hmm. Well, that was one possible view, not necessarily correct. Just example.
Yeah.
The interrelated issue is that those mutations that you're considering are really mutations at different places. But if you have the same beneficial mutation appearing, mm-hmm. then rather than recombination becoming limiting, it really is a question of when the second hit at the same site will occur.
Well, you're saying if it's two different mutations at the same,
so
two different alleles.
The discreteness of the genome is another issue. And in some ways, this is assuming a continuous genome where the hits are all independent.
Yeah, the same nucleotide needed.
Right, or the same, even if it's not exactly the same nucleotide, but the same kind of change is needed, but there's a bin of sites that would allow this.
You could probably incorporate that.
You could.
Yeah, that's probably
easier.
Probably
ends up with an R plus mu at the bottom.
So it's nice, yeah. Okay, cool, thanks.